the Turkish leadership have already lost the trust of the Syrian leadership, and there was a long way to go through in order to rebuild this trust before any rapprochement could be achieved.
Well, Professor Jamal Wakim, academic, author, and political commentator, thank you very much for joining us and for your contribution. Hopefully, we get to see some sort of rapprochement in our region for peace to happen. But let's see what's going on in Iraq next, with the political scene becoming more and more ambiguous.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, the Iraqi political scene is becoming, as we said, more ambiguous after the leader of the Sadrist movement, Muqtada Sadr, rejected the outcomes of the dialogue of the political forces that had called on the Sadrist movement to engage in dialogue to get out of the political crisis. Now, as Sadr called on the Iraqi judiciary to dissolve parliament before the end of this week, stressing that his supporters will continue their sit-in near the parliament inside the Green Zone in central Baghdad. Meanwhile, Iraq's Kata'ib Hezbollah issued a statement calling on wise people to calm down, respect the judiciary, resort to the constitution, and present the principle of reconciliation and peaceful solutions instead of escalation with threats and coercions. No progress in Iraqi political deadlock in this following report.
The crisis in Iraq seems to be stuck between intensifying or worse, exploding. Between these two options, Iraq stands today after the crisis has reached its climax and the street is threatened with the explosion, with the escalation of demonstrations and counter-demonstrations in a game that seemed to have no end except for clash if it continued without any control. Although Muqtada Sadr, apparently motivated by these precautions, postponed the million-man march that he had announced for last Saturday, however, Assad's refusal to participate in the dialogue called by Mustafa al-Kadhimi re-established an atmosphere of pessimism about the possibility of finding a way out of the crisis. Al-Qadhimi seems to be seeking through his call to enhance his credit as a consensual option in order to renew the mission that he originally called, which is the early elections. Assad's move, which came after the federal court avoided saying its word on the issue of the dissolution of parliament, will keep the crisis as it is, unless expectations are true for a close meeting between Assad and Hadi al-Amiri, who is relied upon to make a breakthrough in the political deadlock. Meanwhile, the Iraqi federal court postponed a decision regarding Assad's lawsuit demanding the dissolution of the House of Representatives to August 30, in what appeared to be the court's desire to make way for a settlement through dialogue, which used to make similar steps during the dispute over election results conducted last October. The Supreme Judicial Council had dropped a few days ago a similar lawsuit by the leader of Assad's movement on the grounds of lack of jurisdiction. But the latter still insists on dissolving parliament through the judiciary, given that the first exceeded the constitutional deadlines to elect a new president of the republic, who in turn assigns the candidate of the largest parliamentary bloc to head the government and calls for new early elections supervised by the caretaker government. All the while, the coordinating framework sees that the constitution, in light of the end of the president's term in office and the confinement of the government's tasks as a caretaker cabinet, leaves only one door for dissolving the House of Representatives, that the parliament vote itself on the dissolution at the request of one-third of its members, noting that Assad is no longer represented in this council after the resignation of 73 of his deputies. On the backdrop of preventing the fall of Iraq into a new wave of violence, Iraq's Kata'ib Hezbollah issued a statement in light of such calls to demonstrations, saying, we in the Hezbollah brigades will take field decisions aimed at protecting societal peace in accordance with the mandate to repel evil from our dear people. The party also warned that departing from the rule of peaceful interaction and legitimate protest to the language of incitement may lead to an internal conflict that will return the country to the era of injustice and tyranny.
Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Robert Carter, producer, journalist, and political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Robert, now, the leader of the Sadrist movement, Sayyid Muqtada Sadr, rejected the outcomes of the dialogue by which was presented by the presidencies and the political forces, as well as those who close to him have described the dialogue as weaker than a spider's web. Why would a dialogue amongst different Iraqi political factions be rejected by the Sadrist movement to begin with?
Well, quite frankly, I think that after the results of the previous elections in Iraq, which took place towards the end of last year, Muqtada al-Sadr believes that he heads the biggest political faction and therefore should be entitled to basically set up a government his way, and I think that rival factions have worked to undermine that. He came very close to setting up a coalition government with, I think, some Sunni and Kurdish parties, but that was undermined, and therefore he feels as if he's been forced into a corner where he has to use other means in order to force his will onto Iraq. Now, of course, many are focusing on this this battle for power, and they're zoning it around Muqtada al-Sadr himself and his movement. But I think that there is a bigger picture at play here, potentially the end of the constitution, which was essentially set up by the US following the US occupation and invasion of Iraq, and that potentially in the long term could be a good thing for Iraq, as we know that the US installed system, political system, has failed time and again. And perhaps this is just another example of where this system has again failed and left Iraq in a political deadlock, as it has been many times previously.
Well, another thing added to the refusal of dialogue, Sadr gave a one-week ultimatum to the Iraqi judiciary to dissolve the parliament and announced early parliamentary elections while accentuating that his supporters will keep on with a sit-in near the parliament. Why is Sayyid al-Sadr reneging on his initial position from the results of the Iraqi elections? Didn't he supposedly own the majority back then? What happened to change his mind?
Yes, you're right. He did win a majority, but not an outright majority. So he essentially, although he won more seats, he didn't have enough to form a government entirely on his own. And as I'm sure you know very well, Iraqi politics and the system that's in place, the democratic system that's been given to Iraq, has basically, one of its major issues is that it's divided the political space up into various groups which all compete between one another, and it's very difficult to actually form a government in Iraq because each faction at times seems to be more loyal to themselves than actually the country as a whole. So this is a notorious issue, a sticking point which has been an issue for many times previously. And again, Muqtada tried to form a government on his own. He faced opposition from other Shia majority Muslim parties in the country, and he tried to form his own government using Sunni and Kurdish allies, and that of course has been undermined. So now he's using his strongman tactic, something which Muqtada al-Sadr is very known for, in trying to basically force it his way, regardless of the lack of progress he's achieved in convincing rival blocs to support his government proposal. Now his demands are quite severe. They talk about constitutional changes, political law changes, as well as many others. So, as I say, we could see the end of the failed US-installed political system in Iraq, and potentially that could be a good thing. But in the short term, it looks as if there's going to be a lot of political upheaval as Iraq tries to sort itself out from this latest mess.
Well, Robert, after supporters of the Sadr movement expanded their protests into all of the country, not only in Baghdad, demanding the dissolution of parliament, we saw the coordinating framework, which is basically the political foe of the Assad movement. We saw their supporters also taking to the streets after hearing that Sadr doesn't want to negotiate. How serious is the risk of being drawn into street clashes in Iraq in the event that the judiciary does not really abide by the ultimatum given to Assad or to them?
There is always a risk of violence, unfortunately, breaking out in Iraq. That has been the case for many years. But I think it's worth noting that so far the protests have been relatively peaceful in the sense, going on Iraqi standards, you know, guns haven't been drawn. And that, of course, is a positive to note from this. I also would be very wary of this narrative that Iraq is on the verge of deteriorating into violence, because ultimately a lot of the blame that's being pinned on this in Western media is on so-called Iranian interference in the country and so on and so forth. Quite frankly, I think that the mood for violence is not there in Iraq. Although there is a desire to, you know, slug it out over the who's going to form the new government, I don't see a meaningful potential to turn into violence. And I think that actually neighboring countries like Iran actually do not want to see more violence taking place in Iraq. So they're actually going to play a positive role, perhaps even try to cool tensions. And I hope that in the long term, that's what we'll see coming out of this. But ultimately, these are constitutional issues which are at play. And Muqtada al-Assad is doing what he usually does, which is use populist and strongman tactics just to try and get what he wants. And we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. But ultimately, do I see real violence, like gun battles raging in the streets? No, but we'll have to wait and see if any opposition groups send their supporters out into the streets. If they come face to face with some Sadrists, they could come to blows. Let's hope that doesn't happen, but there is a potential, definitely.
Thank you very much. From London, Robert Carter, producer, journalist, and political commentator, for your views and your contribution to our show. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I am your host, Zainab. We have a roundtable discussion. We listen to what is being said. We deduce the best things out of it. And that's how we come back to reality. Well, today in our studio, we have with us very two special guests. I have Asma on my right hand and brother Mehdi Najafi on my left side. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum. It's good to be here.
Wa alaikum assalam, sister. Very happy to be here with you.
Same here. Asma, would you like to give a little intro? I know you. But
yes.
Just for audience.
Yes, of course. Well, I am Asma, and I have been studying English literature for so long. I'm a deep dive fan of literature, and it's been a while that I'm being here in radio as well.
Well,
at the service of the audience.
Again, Brother Najafi, we'd want to hear from you.
I'm Mehdi, and that's all I am. I have studied business, finance and management, and I am a student in the seminary of Qom.
Well, Brother Najafi, if I ask you, what are the three things that you need to learn to accept in life? What would be those?
First thing would be that I do not know everything.
Okay.
Second thing is... I can be wrong.
All right. You think what's the third thing? I'll ask Asma. What are the three things that you
will die?
Okay. You need to accept that we are going to die.
Oh, yeah. And the third thing is that we won't die.
We want to die?
Yeah.
Yes, okay, we die.
Yeah, we won't die.
The first thing I have to accept in life is that I have accepted already that one day this life is going to end.
The materialistic life will end.
Yes, of course, okay. For sure. But that, of course, but again, it is going to be something mournable. And the next thing is going to be, accept that life is not always the same as you wish it to be.
Okay.
And also accept your weaknesses.
Accept your weaknesses. So what can I deduce from all that?
You have plenty of things to accept in this life.
You don't accept mistakes, Brother Najafi?
I don't accept mistakes.
Do you?
I try to.
Okay. You said I have to learn to accept I could be wrong.
Yeah, three things that have to be learned.
Okay.
Right? First thing was that I could be wrong.
You could
the
be wrong.
The second thing is I do not know everything.
So does that mean that you always think you're always right?
Most of us tend to do that, to be honest.
Okay.
Like, we don't consciously say that, but we tend to have this self-righteousness within us. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Like, unless, you know, have you, all right, I don't know, I'm going to put you in the spotlight here. Have you ever had an experience where you're in an argument and you're losing? Like, you know you're wrong and you just carry on arguing for
you
no reason.
You know, women never lose an argument.
Exactly. That's very true.
Precisely. That's what I'm saying. You are a manifest example of what I said right now. You know, like, I've got one right in front of me. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah.
So realizing you have to accept that sometimes the truth is in front of you.
Yeah. I'm saying that the worst case scenario is that the truth is in front of you. You've actually known that you were wrong.
Yeah.
And you it's just too hard for you to realize and acknowledge that you were wrong. You understand?
Okay.
There's no problem with that. The second thing I was saying is, know that I do not know everything. Al-qawlu ma adri nisful ilm.
Yeah.
You know, like saying that I don't know is half of knowledge, right? You can't learn anything when you think you know everything. You understand?
Of course. Yeah,
it's okay.
It's all right. Yeah, it's okay to not know something, you know? And the third thing is that we won't die. That we have to realize that we don't die.
Yeah.
You know?
So we don't have to be scared of dying here.
Yeah.
Departing our soul.
Okay, departure. Yeah, yeah. Let's call it departure.
Right. Yeah. See?
Leaving for eternal.
She's realized the first point that she could be wrong. You know, that's a good thing.
So I'm a good learner.
We're progressing,
learner.
You know, we're getting somewhere here now.
Nice.
You know what I'm saying?
Fast learner.
Okay.
Yeah, so we have to realize that certain things have to be left behind or have to be not given all the attention, which that attention could be focused somewhere else that helps you grow eternally, right? In that sense.
I'll be continuing this discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We are discussing what are the three things that you need to learn to accept in life.
If I don't die, I know where to plan for.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
If I know that I'm not going to die, I am an infinite being.
Yeah.
I know where to plan for.
But that would be dangerous for some people, though. Because when I think that I won't die, then I would be so brutal.
Yeah, but you don't die. No one dies. That's something
well,
that we
all
realize.
Die. Don't make it philosophical. We all die, but the spirit is not going to die.
Who is we? Define we.
Human beings. The body is going to die.
So you are your body?
No, I'm not my body. My spirit will live on.
Yeah, so you are not dying.
My body is going to die.
Yeah, your body. You know, like your body.
So in this physical world, we're going to say bye to this physical world and go into another world, which is going to be spiritual.
Which means you're not going to die. You don't die.
We die, but our spirit will keep on living.
Well, that's back to reality.
Yeah, come back to reality.
To reality.
Yes.
Listen.
Here, I don't have a difference of opinion with Brother Najafi. We never die. I am with him. We just leave this body over here. And
yeah, but like, that's what I'm saying. Your body, you know, you're saying my body.
Yes.
Means that you are other than your body. You are than your body, which means that we do not die.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
we,
I know.
The concept of we does not
come
die.
Come on, I know that. I know that we have a body and we have a spirit. I know that body dies and the spirit would never die. I know that. I'm saying that the process of departure is something very difficult.
Females are so much attached to their bodies. You need to accept this concept that you have to leave this body.
Yeah, certainly. That's something
valuable. It's really hard to accept.
Yes, it is. It really is.
It's valuable. Mm-hmm. You know, the body is something valuable. I think a kidney is sold for a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
There's some valuable in a sense.
Trader.
But what I'm saying is, when I realized that me, not the body, I am not going to finish, you know, I'm not going to die.
Okay.
That makes my worldview larger, wider, and that makes my focuses, my priorities, is going to switch that completely.
And I think that will make one more thing very easier for you. When any close one leaves from this world, you don't have that much pain.
Anything. Anything. You lose your money. You lose a loved one, you know. You don't get something that you really, really, really wanted, right? That's not going to cause you that trauma, you know. You're not going to commit suicide over an iPhone.
That's very difficult.
You know?
Very difficult. What you're talking about is very difficult.
Yeah, but
I have to learn to accept.
Yes, we have to learn.
Yeah, yeah,
that
fair enough.
Thing.
But out of what? Out of a lifetime. That's what we're talking about, right? The question was three things that you want throughout your life, right?
Yeah.
So that's a long period to accept only three things, right?
Yes, yes.
So this out of a lifetime, just take this one thing out of a lifetime. I think a lifetime is enough for us to acknowledge that there's just one thing that I need to accept. You understand? In that sense, it might be difficult in a minute,
true.
In a year, right? But in a lifetime. You know?
I think I need to learn and accept that people don't die for you. I am so much associated in every relation. I'm so, so emotional. And then I am in that emotional trauma.
Do not invest on people.
I won't say exactly that, but I have to learn that life moves on and not like everyone stops with you.
So sad.
People move on. Okay, well, the second thing that I have to accept is that sometimes my husband could be right. When I say, no, I was right. But with the time, I realize he was right. So, yes, I am. One of the things I have to learn is that
Easily, because only sometimes he can be right.
Yes, yes. You can't be right all the time. Seriously.
Yes, and sometimes. Some very little time.
Yeah, but rarely.
It is so hard for females, especially, to accept that. Especially if you're a female. Asma, what do you say about that?
I'm not like that. I accept something which is right, no matter what, even if it's against me. I usually accept it very
easily. That is a massive claim, you know that. That's a massive claim.
Yes, I am like that. I would accept the truth if I could get justified. If they justify me, then I would believe...
Right, so you have to be talked out of your mentality. Someone has to convince you first.
Yes, yes.
Someone has to convince her.
That's the most the hardest thing to do for, like two women. Like, convincing women is the hardest thing.
No, if there's a logic behind it, it's not very difficult.
Right.
If there is logic, then it's not very difficult.
Well, coming back to the last thing is that I have to accept that time will not come back. There are certain things we put.
That's very true.
We put on like I'll be having some time in life to say sorry to someone, to, you know, to do other things, to do other important tasks. But we have to accept that time is flying.
It reminds me of Hadith Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. He says, كَمْ مِنْ مُسَوِّفٍ مِنَّ الْعَجَلِ حَتَّى هَجَمَ عَلَيْهِمُ الْأَجَلِ. Like, so many people, like, you know, procrastination. He's like, كَمْ مِنْ مُسَوِّفٍ, like, sofa, I'll do it later. Whereas they were supposed to be quick and hasty on that. حَتَّى هَجَمَ عَلَيْهِمُ الْأَجَلِ. People tend to procrastinate over things they were supposed to do instantly to the time that they meet their own death.
Exactly. And I have learned a bit little to take care of that after I went to the contemplation of Surah Asr, which swears on the time, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that you all are in loss, human being is in loss. So yes, I had to, the third one was the most important one. I have to accept that time is passing. I don't have enough time to do things tomorrow or day after, or like leave my tasks for tomorrow. Well, we came to the conclusion that in this world, as Brother Najafi put it, like, we are going to live forever. That's one of the realities we have to accept. Mm-hmm. That would take us out of all the traumas we face. And it's very, very hard to come out of traumas. But one of the things that could really, really help us is accepting that we are going to live forever. That's one. And other thing was that we could be wrong. We could be wrong. And that was one of the common things, I think.
And that we have a limited time within our bodies.
We have limited time. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The source of all power, my need in my darkest hour, my Lord. Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need, my Lord.
My Lord,
protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger among us.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Welcome back to the lecture series. The lecture series, as you know, has been titled The Quiet Before the Storm. What we're trying to do is to examine the words, the teachings, the stances, and the thoughts of Sayyid al-Shuhada. The idea is to learn relevant lessons before our Imam returns. We want to learn lessons that apply to us, that make us ready to accept the wilaya of God on the earth. So tonight's reminder from Abu Abdullah, brothers and sisters, is called Cultivating the Love of Imam Hussein in the Next Generation of Muslims. Cultivating the Love of Imam Hussein in the Next Generation of Muslims. We have a beautiful hadith from our Prophet. It's narrated that our Prophet said this, Addibu awladakum, train your children to have three noble traits. What are the three noble traits? حُبُّ نَبِيِّكُمْ. The first of them is the love of your Prophet. وَحُبُّ أَهْلِ بَيْتِهِ. The love of his Ahlul Bayt. وَتِلَاوَةِ الْقُرْآنِ. And also, your children, they should love to recite the Qur'an. So, brothers and sisters, as you listen to the poetry of our dear brother, and you remind yourself of what we read in the books of history, you know and you recognize that children played a huge role in the advent of Karbala. They're part of what makes the story so special. Now, what I want to do is to explain about a family, to talk a little bit about one of the families in this incredible story. And then after that, to see if there's any lessons that we can draw from their story. The hero in our story, according to some accounts, is a preteen. Some accounts, there's differences amongst the historians on the age of this young man, definitely a young man, but some say 13, some say 9. Young man. His name is Amr bin Junada al-Ansari. But I want to talk about his family. This story, you might know this man, but maybe not by name, but you might know him by his line of epic poetry. That line of epic poetry that Amr recited is Amiri Hussein wa Ni'mal Amir. Even that line needs discussion. My Amir, my leader, my role model, my example, my everything is Hussein. And what an excellent Amir he is. But his story is a very incredible one. What happens is, he has come to the battle with his family. So the family of Amr, they meet Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Mecca. What happens is, Janada, his father. So this is Amr bin Janada. And his mother is, according to some accounts, is named Bahriya. This small family is traveling. The father is one of the companions of Rasulullah. Ashab Rasulullah. And he was a loyal companion. He actually did a tour of duty in Siffin. He was a loyal Shia. He was there active doing his social and political responsibilities, even in the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And then now, when he hears the Imam is exiting Mecca, at that time is when this small family joins the Imam on that caravan moving to heaven. What happens is that Janada, Amr, his mother, They're all moving towards Karbala. And on the day of Karbala is when his father finally realizes that dream that he had, that hope that every Shia has. He was able, he was gifted, he had the tawfiq to fight for Imam Hussein, Sayyid al-Shuhada, and to be martyred. But their story doesn't end there. In this story, the mother is a heroine. The mother is all in for the cause. She's just lost her husband. She's there, but she realizes the gravity of the situation, the seriousness of the situation, and her attitude is next man up. She tells her young son, go and fight and defend the daughter, the son of Fatima. Go fight and defend the son of Rasulullah. This young man comes out and respectfully asks Imam Hussein for permission to fight. The Imam tells him no. When he asks for permission to fight, the Imam says words to this effect, that he's a young man. They've just given one person in the way of Allah. His father just passed. They fought. Maybe his mother is not happy with him also becoming shaheed. The young man answers. He says, Ummi amaratni bidhalik. My mother is the one who told me to go over and fight. When the Imam sees that level of sacrifice, this young man ready to take on the Yazids and Shimrs of his time, this young man advances, and then he begins to recite that epic poetry, Amiri Hussein wa Ni'mal Amir. Even when you look at his epic poetry, that's interesting. His epic poetry doesn't reflect the name of his tribe, or his father, or any of his personal achievements. Everything for him, if you read the lines of poetry, is Imam Hussein. Everything for him is Hussein. He's martyred. When he's martyred, the enemy callously throws the head of this young man back towards the camp of Imam Hussein. Every stance of these people who had received tarbiyah from Sayyid al-Shuhada is a lesson for us. The mother takes the head and throws the head back at the camp of the enemy. What is the message that she's sending by doing this? He was given in the way of Allah. I don't regret anything. So now the question for all of us when we hear these wonderful stories is, how is it that a family would succeed in doing, following those instructions, that the love of Allah, the love of Rasul, the love of Islam has been manifested not only in the father and the mother, but in the young boy to the extent that not as his goal isn't just to practice Islam, his love, his desire is shahada. Even when the Imam gives him a way out, he says, no, I've got to go. What did they do? What's there in the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt that would enable someone so young to make these choices?
To Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
The JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was a deal to put Iran and the world at ease. It would limit this country's peaceful but suspected nuclear program in return for lifting economic nuclear-related UN sanctions off it. It was a deal between Iran and the P5+1, the permanent UN Security Council members, which are the US, UK, France, Russia, China, plus Germany. But 3 years in, the U.S. unilaterally and most would say illegally backed out.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Thinking Iran weak and possible to press into signing a yet more comprehensive action plan or nuclear deal plus. Iran responded proportionately to pressure the West into making the agreement work. And sure enough, talks to restore the deal have now been going on for a year and a half. Some even say they're practically concluded in a brand new JCPOA. Concerns, content, time frame and verification. These are four talking points on the JCPOA, which was repackaged as the best pact possible by the EU and embraced by the US. Now what remains is for them to agree to Iran's disagreements. Iran will finalize with a signing once its red lines are observed in writing. The talks we refer to are the closest ever to final talks, which concluded August the 8th. They're subject of much review and discussion here as much as anywhere else. So stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Iran is after a good, sustainable and strong agreement, and as Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian insists, if the other side speaks of a plan B, we also have a plan B.
They talk about plan B. We also have our own plan B, but we believe that in the end, this matter should be resolved with the realistic approach of all parties through negotiations.
In other words, Iran is not going to be unilaterally bombarded with more extraneous demands when it was in active compliance with the JCPOA or nuclear deal of 2015, unlike Western parties to the deal.
One of the possible scenarios is that either the Americans will agree with Iran's proposal based on the EU plan, in which case an agreement will be made, and they'll move on to sign it or verify it. Or maybe the Americans will have some reservations or prudence, which will be relayed to the other parties. Then the negotiations will continue once more, so that all parties will be in full agreement on the final text. I hope that the response of the Americans to Iran's proposal is positive, and that the United States returns to the JCPOA as soon as possible. But if that doesn't take place, it doesn't seem like either of the parties would be willing to declare an end to the negotiations. Since the end of the negotiations or a world without the JCPOA can be a dangerous thing, they prefer that the negotiations continue.
Now, sanction lifting has been a priority also with the relatively recent Raisi administration in Iran. But the administration hasn't placed enough importance on this priority to want to sacrifice its fundamentals for it. For example, it has not noted domestic economy and people's lives to the JCPOA. And that is why it has been looking eastwards, even signing long-term agreements with Russia and Venezuela, the U.S. sanctions club.
With a look to the east and an inward look to our own home, neighbors became a greater priority as strengthening domestic industry became a greater issue. This while Iran has strictly persisted in keeping the Vienna talks on track.
One of the most important differences between the current Iranian negotiation team under President Raisi and the previous negotiation team under President Rouhani is that the current negotiation team believes that if we want to have a balanced negotiation and balanced agreement at the end, we have to produce some leverage. And the previous team of Iran, Zarif and Araghchi, they didn't believe so on that. So they wanted to make, they trusted the Biden administration.
We're focusing our efforts on a second goal, the neutralization of sanctions. What it means is that whether sanctions are implemented or removed, we must safeguard our domestic economy against the ripple effect of sanctions that the U.S. or others might implement against Iran and decrease our vulnerability. We have taken important steps toward this end. One of its aspects is the policies adopted by the government in the field of foreign policy.
Iran's red lines and demands remain mostly the same. They begin with verification of sanction lifting and guarantee of commitment on the part of the U.S. Changes are detectable mostly in the detail of the talks and method of talks and texts. EU top diplomat Joseph Borrell presented a best deal possible, which many think is a take-it-or-break-it deal. But to Iran, it is still an imperfect matter of further negotiation. Parliament was briefed on talks in a special session so that it comes up with a decision and operational plan.
At this stage, the Parliament is not meant to approve or reject anything, and the representatives are merely being informed, since they are part of the supervisory entity that oversees the government and executive bodies and subsequently must be informed about the process of negotiations. In the period when the representatives expressed their opinions, some key issues were mentioned. First was the Strategic Action Plan to Counter Sanctions, which is the 11th Parliament's roadmap to deal with the issue of nuclear negotiations. The representatives also emphasized on a few other issues, which included the verification process.
If the United States withdrew from the deal once more, the Iranians should be turned off the cameras who are monitoring Iranian nuclear program from the first day that the United States withdrew. They could also, said that the inspector of the IAEA should go out of the country from the first day if United States withdrew from the deal.
A major sticking point with the talks has been accusations there's nuclear pollution in three undeclared Iranian sites. Now, if that were true, it would go to way before the 2015 nuclear deal. Anyway, it's been a while. Iran has noticed the IAEA has been acting politically rather than technically, which is why it doesn't trust the UN nuclear watchdog anymore. For example, it's been passing resolutions against this country based on unfounded for allegations and accusations by enemies. Whereas till before hostilities began peaking, it declared 15 times that Iran was in full compliance with the JCPOA or nuclear deal. Iran's main concerns regarding the JCPOA and its approval center on three main axes. Resolving a dispute with the nuclear agency over three sites in Iran said to be uranium contaminated, executive guarantee from the U.S. to remain in the JCPOA, and verification of the lifting of sanctions.
They keep raising claims about certain locations that are said to be contaminated by uranium. These claims have no basis. Raising such issues is not based on logic, and some elements who oppose the agreement, including those affiliated with the Zionist regime, are attempting to bring up excuses to challenge any cooperation between Iran and the IAEA in nuclear issues. According to our agreement, we held three rounds of in-person negotiations to address the details and concerns of this report and questions that the agency's inspectors have. After the second round of the negotiations, we realized that once again political motivations are involved. Unfortunately, the IAEA's director general expressed concerns about Iran's goodwill before the negotiations were concluded, and even his trip to the occupied territories was unconstructive. That's why we emphasize today that if any party wants a return to the 2015 agreement, they must help Iran close the IAEA case for good.
Regarding content, the other side, basically meaning the U.S. and other Western parties to the deal, were out to scrap or limit Iran's missile and military program and regional policy. They seriously pursued regional talks till February and March.
One of the main demands by the Americans since Obama, Trump, and then the Biden administration has been to include Iran's missile program and regional influence in the JCPOA and nuclear negotiations. So far, and based on the information that has been leaked, the Islamic Republic has not approved this demand. Based on the leader's speech a few years ago, when the JCPOA came into effect, they said that if this is a successful experience and the Americans don't break their promise and honor their obligations, it is possible for Iran to enter negotiations on other matters with the Americans.
The West may have tried to get concessions from Iran by most any means possible. The U.S. even unleashed a maximum pressure campaign on this country by reimposing U.N. sanctions and adding to them as U.S. sanctions. But it only backfired in licensing Iran to back out of its own commitments. Iran continued with its uranium enrichment, enriching uranium to 60% to keep. In less than an hour, since 6 to 7 ships and a number of individuals were sanctioned, Iran injected gas into 500 centrifuges.
Iran's nuclear program is entirely domestic and is comprised of different components from mining, where we extract uranium, to enriching radioactive material, which can be used for peaceful purposes like reactors or radiopharmaceutical purposes. We have attained the entire process in Iran, and no negotiations today can remove any stage of this process. We can negotiate about the volume of extent of the enrichment process and the number of centrifuges and increase or decrease it, but the removal of any steps in this process is unacceptable and out of question.
This country has been using IR-6 centrifuges with modified subheaders for a while now. This has meant an enrichment process to create uranium isotopes enriched up to 20%. Already well above JCPOA license limits of 3.67% with uranium enriched up to 20%, Iran continued up to 60%. The special subheaders that are now in use allow for easier and faster switching to higher purity levels. All this in response to the U.S. pullout and unfair, largely illegal sanctions. In fact, when the IAEA finally passed the resolution against us, Iran just turned off surveillance cameras used by that agency to monitor a nuclear site here. This was a worry to the West. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Coming up, but first a quick diversion to see what other media outlets have to say. I've got a source here used less on this show, but a good one for business and markets nevertheless. Asia Nikkei, that is, which reads, what an Iran nuclear deal would mean for strained oil markets. A last-ditch attempt by Europe to revive the Iranian nuclear deal has stoked speculation that millions of barrels of oil could soon flow into world markets, though analysts and experts are tempering their optimism.
Should such an agreement materialize, Tehran would ramp up sales within months, raising supply by hundreds of thousands of barrels a day, according to the IAEA, that's the UN nuclear watchdog. That would help alleviate a tight global market that has been shaken by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The outlook of a quick return of Iranian supplies has helped keep benchmark Brent crude below $100 a barrel this month, a level it's mostly exceeded since the start of the Ukraine war in February. Analysts say European Union ban on Russian seaborne oil set to take effect on December the 5th gives the bloc added incentive to secure the Iranian nuclear deal, even as similar motivation for the US might be fading. Reuters gives us a look at how the other side views what's going on with the deal. Leaders of the US, UK, France and Germany discuss the Iran nuclear issue. The leaders of these four countries discussed efforts to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, the White House said in a statement largely focused on Ukraine. In addition, they discussed ongoing negotiations over Iran's nuclear program, the need to strengthen support for partners in the Middle East region, and joint efforts to deter and constrain Iran's destabilizing regional activities, as the White House put it in its description of the call among the four. Failure in the nuclear negotiations could raise the risk of a fresh regional war, with Israel threatening military action against Iran if diplomacy fails to prevent Tehran from developing a nuclear weapons capability. Iran, which has long denied having such ambitions, has warned of a crushing response to any Israeli attack. Now, Israel has been throwing about threats, but according to Meir News, Israel in a hole of its own making. In 2018, while the whole world was warning of the consequences of scuppering the nuclear deal, formerly called the JCPOA, the then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu decided to buck the trend and nudge then US President Donald Trump into quitting the JCPOA. That decision has now backfired on Israel, according to Israeli media. The official Israeli television channel Kan reported that Israeli security leaders have privately expressed their regret over the pressure exerted by Tel Aviv over Trump to abandon the JCPOA in 2018, according to Al Arabi Al Jadid. That contrition, the report said, sprang from a belief that both Iran and the great powers are returning to the same agreement at a time when Iran has achieved great progress in its nuclear program, especially in the field of uranium enrichment, which could have been averted were it not for the Trump withdrawal from the nuclear pact. Internal opposition to Israel's anti-JCPOA policies is nothing new. Israeli intelligence and security officials have long called for a return to the JCPOA. In February of 2021, a group of former security and intelligence officials sent a letter to Netanyahu expressing support for a U.S. return to the JCPOA. That would be it for the news section. Please stay tuned. The Ukraine war, which has gotten Russia boycotted by the West, has meant a lack of energy flowing to Europe, and therefore it has raised fuel prices as the coal season is about to set in. It hasn't exactly been a win for the West, as Russia, like Iran, turns east and to the US sanctions club. As it does so, Iran, for its part, has entered talks stronger than before. That's to say, it finds itself in a position to demand America pass it the ball. Yes, the ball to get talks rolling into results is in the US's court. Because it was the US that unraveled the JCPOA down to its constituent letters to begin with, pushing Iran to reverse its own commitment in advancing with its nuclear program. America doesn't seem to object as before, coming to see sense in Joseph Borrell's draft.
It is important to note that the Iran profile, Iran case as a whole, is a bipartisan issue in Congress. And both parties in the United States want to contain Iran. They don't just care about Iran nuclear program. They know that the Iran nuclear issues and resolving these issues or addressing these issues is just the first step to go beyond that for the Middle Eastern security issues, for the regional politics, for containing Iran missiles and air defense issues. So all of this. And, just putting some barriers on Iranian nuclear advancement is not benefiting the Biden administration. If the Biden administration could come to sort of agreement with Iran on reviving the JCPOA, I am sure that not only the Republican parties and their media, whatever in the deal, whatever written in the deal, it is not important. The Republican parties would be against that. Also, some of the most important and prominent members of Democratic parties and their media also would be against that deal.
For U.S. President Joe Biden to get the JC